Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. We're going to be getting into the next AA Grapevine article on emotional sobriety, but briefly, I'd just like to check in with you all. How's our emotional sobriety this morning? First with Carol.
Oh, let's see. Actually, I'm doing great. I always feel good when I visit with you guys. I've had some challenges recently, and emotional sobriety is helping me get through them. When you feel bad, you have to manage yourself. And I'm managing myself to stay out of doomsday thinking just because my body's hurting right now. And I'm doing okay with it.
Not just because your body's hurting. Your body's hurting. So I don't
my body's hurting.
Because your body's hurting.
Yeah. No, my body really hurts. I'm on week 13 of shingles. I have postherpetic neuralgia. Wish I didn't. But I'm managing myself and I'm doing okay. Good. So I'm grateful for emotional sobriety.
It seems counterintuitive that when your body hurts, that emotional sobriety would be the thing that could come through for you and kind of fill those gaps. But can you explain just briefly?
Yes. Week 3, I started catastrophizing and fantasizing that this would never go away and my life would be hell. And I didn't know if I could make it. Well, guess what? Sure, I can. And if it doesn't go away, I can still make it. But I plan on it going away. I hope it goes away. I think it'll go away. It does for most people. So I'm not worried about it. I really surrendered it. And I'm just not going to catastrophize. I'm staying in the moment. If I start hearing little whispers of stinking thinking, I call my daughter or call some friends to talk about anything. And it goes away. So I'm just using my tools of staying in community with my people and managing my thinking.
I'll just tag on to that real quickly. That I want to make amends and apologize to Carol, because as soon as she told us what she was going through, I sent her an email that said, this is a catastrophe and I don't think it's ever going to go away. And I think you're just doomed forever. And apparently that was not the right thing to say. So I will be working on getting a little bit more clear and honest from here on. But anyway, I'm good. I forgot we were doing it. I was sitting out in my backyard. The weather's nice today, reading a novel, and I got a text that I was supposed to be working. So I'm glad to be here and looking forward to getting back to my novel.
What novel are you reading, Tom?
The Man Who Died Twice. It's a series from an English humorist. Osmond. Can't remember his first name. His last name is Osmond, and it's a series of the Thursday Murder Club. It's just light fun reading. This is the second book in four, I think, and I just finished a pretty heavy book the other day, and I thought I need something to, just for fun, and this one's just wonderful. He's a great writer and he's hilarious.
I just imagine a doppelganger for Tom, who is an English humorist rather than a Southern gentleman.
Right.
It's like, you know, he looks just like Tom, but he's wearing like tweed and, you know, it's
bow tie.
Oh.
I have one of those hats like Alan's. It's like, you know.
I was at the gas station, spread very thin, trying to do too many things at once. And I left my wallet on top of the car and then drove away with it and lost all my cards and everything right before a trip I have to take. But at the same time, trying to help. Dealing with some people in the program and trying to help and feeling, people that are suffering, I don't always know what to say or how to come through for them. And here I am in the meantime, sober 6 years and still getting loose like that and watching my wallet sail off into traffic, you know, despite my best intentions. So that gets a little stressful sometimes. I'm trying to... trying my best, I think.
I had that happen at Disneyland. We pulled into a McDonald's. I went and bought everybody food, and I put my wallet on the top, drove away. Halfway down the freeway, I realized, oh, shit, my wallet was on the roof. I got a call from two people from Brazil that found my wallet and tracked me down on the internet. And I went back and met them, and they gave me my wallet back.
There you go.
I mean...
There's hope. There may be hope. I don't know. It's like that gives you something.
That was one of those things about emotional sobriety. I lost it. I went back. I tried to find it. I went inside to McDonald's. I called the McDonald's. They couldn't find it. But, you know, somebody came through and with me.
I love it.
Then I get back on the freeway. What happens? I get a flat tire. It was one of those days. This is going to test my emotional sobriety. Well, I'm in a similar place that you are, Carol. The difference, I think, is that I am probably looking at a lifetime of having to deal with this peripheral neuropathy I have. And it's funny, now that's most of the pain in my leg has subsided, you know, because I think the fracture is really healing now. And I only have some pain in the evening, which goes away if I ice it well. Now my feet are keeping me awake. I have not been able to get to sleep until 3:30 in the morning. And then I'm only falling asleep because pretty much I pass out. I mean, but my feet, I have to get out of the bed. I have to walk around. I can't even lay down. I mean, I'm going to talk to the podiatrist, but from what I know about peripheral neuropathy, they don't have any real... I mean, I'm taking the gabapentin, which is what they recommend, but that's hardly touching it.
I'm in
the other side of this is back to where you got is that, look, if I have to live with this the rest of my life, I'll figure out a way because I don't have. I mean, that's acceptance, right? Acceptance is the prerequisite to change. And like you said, is that when I fight it and say, oh, I don't want this,
it doubles down.
Well, it does double. Down because then I lose the capacity to cope.
Yeah.
Right? It's at that point in time it evaporates. I mean, so it's back to this even if consciousness that we talk about. Sometimes, like you said, it takes a minute to get there. It's not always readily available. Sometimes it is. Sometimes I can grab that concept and really use it to navigate whatever I'm going through. But other times I have to rediscover it almost. It's on my desk somewhere. Where did I put it? Right.
Well, it's back to the first step, isn't it, Alan? I mean, truth is we're all recovering from something chronic. And so we can also be each other's and our own role model for how to deal with it. It's just, you have to plug in the new content and it's like, you're powerless over your peripheral neuropathy. It's like, you know, and it's like, you know, and I was going to say this to Patrick when he was talking about just 6 years and it still happened. The number of years doesn't fucking matter in terms of what we experience. We're just as human anytime along the way. That's all that is. It's like we'll be leaving our wallets, both literally and figuratively, we'll be leaving our wallets on top of the car, you know, at various times just because we're human. And Alan, I'm sorry to hear that, and I know you'll deal with it, and know that we're here to support.
Absolutely. Did you have this before your surgery?
Yes. You know, I think the surgery has aggravated it, though. I will say, I don't remember. I mean, before with 2 Advil, I used to be able to control it, and now I'm taking 3 Advil, and it's still not touching it. I mean, plus a half a tramadol and plus 300 milligrams, sometimes 600 milligrams of gabapentin, and it's nothing.
Do you use that dual action Advil? When I needed that, that made a world of difference for me.
I've tried it. They had me on a lot of Advil and Tylenol. And the Tylenol, I stopped it because I don't get relief from Tylenol for some reason.
Well, I don't either. But when they gave me the combination, it worked. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
for me, for some reason, they do. They advocate that a lot because they supposedly hit different pain receptors.
Yeah. So. No, but I always scoff at Tylenol. So, you can take Tylenol. I go like, yeah, I guess I could eat M&Ms too, but you know that's not going to help my pain.
Well, actually, from a neurotransmitter point of view, M&Ms might do you some good. You might care about it less.
here on our podcast, we like to cover science.
Hey, let's not talk about advocating anything because I'm a
good friend.
Good point. Good friend of mine, a psychologist, is She ended up having to be, her license was put on probation because she talked about taking some kind of a supplement to deal with anxiety. And one of her listeners reported her.
Oh, wow.
They investigated her and they said to her, you were practicing outside of this year's scope. You know, you're not a medical doctor. You can't recommend supplements for this and that. And she did it in a way that, like, I've just known some people that have used it, but because it's a psychologist saying it, it's so, you know, we are not recommending M&Ms.
No.
Please.
No. Oh, and no, I was playing with Tom.
I am, but I'm doing it as a certified candy provider. And it's like I am internationally certified as a candy provider, so you guys can't do it, maybe, but I can.
The candy man can, but I can't.
Candy man. Hey, that might be a song.
Yeah, just might.
No, that wouldn't work.
All right, well, here we are. I'll set this thing up. Here we go. We're continuing to explore all these wonderful Grapevine articles. The Grapevine has committed the whole month of January's issue to members who wrote in about emotional sobriety. And we've been week by week by week going through these articles and reading them to you. And then if there's any way that we can sweeten the pot at the end of it, we try to do so. And so today we're talking about, this is the January 2024 Grapevine article, Life Goes On, by Alan West from West Lynn, Oregon. And the header says he lovingly recalls the wisdom and kindness the sponsor gave him to reach out and pass on to others. This morning, I read the prayer of St. Francis, my sponsor Jack's favorite prayer. He helped me get into the prayer throughout our sponsor and sponsee relationship. About 5 months ago, I separated from my first wife, and today I plan to wrap up the quit claim to the house on my lunch hour. I also planned to deposit the Seven Tradition collection for our previous day's Tuesday noon downtown AA meeting. After getting my quit claim deed notarized, I wanted some chocolate, something fierce. Look at that, Tom. You anticipated.
There you go. Job for me.
But the thought came to me to rely on something from inside me. This alcoholic first looks outside himself to feel better. Boy, how many of us relate to that, right?
Yep.
I stopped walking and leaned against the trunk of a tree and faced the sun. Downtown was pretty busy, I noticed. The tree supported me. The sun warmed my cheeks. I thank God for Jack helping me through my recent personal turmoil. I didn't have time to make the bank deposit as my lunch hour had waned to a halt, so I double-timed back to the office.
At about 3:30, while working at my desk, I got a phone call. It was Jack's daughter. She called to tell me that Jack had died around 1 p.m. that day. She gave me the time and place for the funeral. After I hung up the phone, I realized that I had been at the notary public finishing my quitclaim to the deed when he died. I shook my head and grinned at yet another strange synchronicity I've experienced more than once in my sober life. Jack quitclaimed his body right when I was quitclaiming my deed. Jack was just another drunk like me, but he drank for three times as many decades as I did. Jack had 11 years of sobriety, and after our last AA meeting together, he told me he didn't expect to live much longer. Jack was close to 80, and his body was beaten down from diabetes and a lifetime of active alcoholism. But he sure lived the spirit of sobriety.
In our last phone conversation 3 days ago, Jack told me some AA pals got him to the noon speakers meeting. One of the guys had the same physical limitations as Jack, confined to a wheelchair, and it was that man who whipped up the posse to round up Jack for the meeting. After a pause, I confessed a resentment I had to Jack, and after a short silence, he said, "They're just people. It shows you're human." "Yes, I am, Jack," I replied, "and I am human, and I really am not that much different than my fellow Earth peddlers, except for that one teeny tiny admission in our first step." After another pause, I reminded him not to pick up a drink. He agreed. It's always good for me to be told that by a friend. For what's good for this alcoholic might be good for another drunk like me.
Carol? Usually at the end of our phone calls, we would plan for me to pick Jack up for a meeting. But this time we made no plan
And our last talk ended with his calm, assured, and thoughtful tone guiding me. Take care of yourself, he said. Don't step on your own tongue. That was such a Jack thing to say. In the office after the call from Jack's daughter, my thoughts went to our meeting's seventh tradition, cash in my pocket. My thought went something like, well, Jack is dead now. I lost my sponsor. Maybe I can take a break and buy chocolate and coffee with this money. I'll pay it back.
Wow. I'm treading on dangerous ground, I thought. I can go to jail for embezzlement. For sure, our AA group will take away my privilege to serve. I might even drink. None of those options were acceptable. The big book says that fear and tension makes for more drinking. I'm sober today only by living by our AA principles. My sponsor died today. He showed me by his actions that we can live useful, happy lives. We do not have to die drunk. In our last phone conversation, Jack told me that the speaker at the meeting his pals had taken him to was celebrating 40 years of sobriety. Jack then relayed a story to me about an AA member who, driving his car to a meeting to celebrate his 25th year, accidentally struck and killed a child. Hey. Sat there and wondered if he joined the meeting in God's realm on time or late. You get there when you get there, I said to myself.
I stood up. I stuffed my hand into my pocket, bulging with cash from our AA meeting, and I squeezed my fingers around the cash. I let go. I closed my eyes, and in the silence, I gave thanks. Then my hand left my pocket and dialed the phone number of my new temporary sponsor. I left a message and got back to work. I was intense.
Okay, that's my favorite one now. Every damn one of them is my favorite. Yeah. After we read these, this is so beautiful.
What's been reiterated a number of times on the podcast is the most emotional sobriety is about freedom. You know, it's freedom, not necessarily happiness, though those right. two tend to overlap with each other. Yeah, and the work is never done. This is something that we have to practice throughout our lives.
I'm troubled by this, though. I'm in a different place, Tom, than you are with it. I don't know. I don't understand the point he's making here in this second to the last paragraph. When he's saying that his sponsor relayed a story to him about an AA member who was driving his car to a meeting to celebrate his 25th birthday, right? Yeah. And then he accidentally struck and killed a child. I sat there and wondered if he, now who's he referring to? Is he referring to the guy that was driving?
No, I got lost with that too. I just didn't work to assign the pronoun.
I figured he meant his sponsor.
That's what I thought.
It was awkwardly written there.
See, that is a weird, I don't like that. I just think that, you know, I just don't understand what his point is. You get there when you get there. I said, what is he? I see, this is, I don't know. You guys had the same reaction to that piece?
I didn't. Yeah. I just let it go. Cause I didn't understand where the pronoun reference didn't make sense to me. I figured the only one who had died there was the child. And I figured he wasn't looking for an AA meeting. So it's
weird. It's like, there's no empathy about the child in the thing. And it's like, my heart goes to that child and his family. And, you know, yes, we make some terrible mistakes even when we're sober. I mean, and that this is maybe a point that I would elaborate from this is that, look, you know, even though we're in recovery, it doesn't create an immunity to life and to making mistakes in life.
Well, what we wouldn't do, Alan, is whether we're hopefully writing or speaking, we would, and I've probably done this at times. So just have some empathy. Is like, I wouldn't toss in a story like that right at the end of whatever it is I'm presenting. You know, by the way, because it does take it in a different direction.
It doesn't. No. I think the other thing that I was troubled by is that he fantasizes that if he borrowed $5 from the cash that they're going to embezzle him and he's going to go to jail the rest of his life. I mean, come on.
A tad catastrophizing, I would say.
Oh my God. And, I mean, I see a lot of non-emotional sobriety in this story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, to me, the issue becomes, I don't know. I this is my least favorite, Tom. I'm in a different
place. All right. Well, what I did was I just ignored that. I didn't realize I was doing it, but I just basically used some of my old defense mechanisms, probably hard won through my family growing up. I just did the whole thing without that paragraph because I didn't know. I didn't think about that consciously, but when you say that, I go like, yeah, that paragraph confused me about why, you know, I remember thinking as we were reading, I was thinking, well, where's this coming from? And, yeah. So anyway, but no, when you look at it fully like that, there's nothing you're saying I'm disagreeing with, Alan.
I get the feeling he's saying his sponsor brought it up as an example that you can be sober and still have horrible things happen. And him being sober and thinking about taking the money. I guess.
We have to guess. It's just poor. To me, it takes a lot of that. I guess I'm not as creative as you are, Carol.
That's a defense mechanism too. Are you kidding? I sunshined my way through my early years.
So my emotional sobriety from this is that I can stay sober even after reading an article like this.
Well, we'll see. It's like, is it
no.
Call me if you need help, man.
But look, look at facing death in our recovery and losing someone as important to us as a sponsor or a family member.
There you go.
Yeah, I think that's the part I wish he would have elaborated more on in terms of how he coped with that. You know, how do we deal with loss in recovery? And we're all going to suffer that. We're all going to suffer disappointment.
Yeah.
And see, to me, is the opportunity maybe that was missed here, is that he experienced a lot of disappointment. He's got a marriage that ends up. He's quit claiming the home to his house. He's got a sponsor that was on his last leg and died during this whole process of wrapping up his divorce. I mean, so, you know, how does he continue to support himself through all of this loss and through losing someone as important, you know, as his sponsor at this particular point in time? And look, this speaks to the importance of us having a lot of support in a lot of different areas.
Yes.
If we put all our eggs in one basket, guess what's happening?
We're toast.
Yeah, well, we run the risk of ending in the same place that he does when something either that could be expected, you know, Jack's sponsor was obviously getting old and struggling from a lot of different medical problems. But even unexpectedly, you know, how many times we hear somebody just die of a heart attack at 50 years old or so? I mean, for the widow killer, right? You know, in terms of that.
Yeah.
So listen, that's to me the message that I hope we can send out to people here, that, you know, emotional sobriety is about facing these vicissitudes of life and be able to face them and get to a place where we can breathe, allow ourselves to feel what we need to feel to heal. Yeah. And I really think it's through grieving properly that we recover the lost parts of ourselves that we all experience when we lose someone important to us. Because we, you know, when we make an investment in someone and we lose them, we lose a part of ourselves. And so that's, to me, the message here is, you know, don't run away from that grief. Don't run away from your disappointment. Don't run away from your pain. There are many important things that we can gain from it if we can endure that pain and go for the meaning and wisdom that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And his acquiring of a temporary sponsor after that very important person in his life passed, I think shows
that was cool. I like that too, Patrick.
He anticipated it, and we call that anticipatory coping. Is when you see something coming that's inevitable, you know, you get ready for it. I just say, this is my post-traumatic stress. So in Vietnam, we would make sure we had plenty of ammo. If there was some intelligence that's saying that we were going to get hit that night. So we make sure that we restocked everything. So
the same principle, different content, same principle.
Yes,
absolutely.
Is. I'm glad we're talking about this. I lost a couple of really important people to me, and it was very hard for a long time, but I did the grief work A friend of mine was hit by a drunk driver and killed instantly. And his wife and I were very close too. And Tom met her. It was Sandy.
Oh.
And Tom helped with, we did a, Tom did a workshop in Dallas, a one day deal. And he was very helpful to Sandy in facing grief. And what he shared with her has helped me a lot. And that is that just because the person you were close to has passed away doesn't mean the relationship has stopped. Yeah. And I talk to Horton and Sandy a lot. Yeah. And feel them. I hear them with me.
Yeah, that's cool.
She was a spiritual director after Horton died. She finished graduate school. And
yeah.
Well, anyway, well, the relationship doesn't have to stop. And you can build on it with other people.
No, it doesn't. But the part of us that was invested does get lost. And it does take the tears to get that back. And as you get it back, the relationship with that person will now exist in another way, metaphysically, like that you're
yes.
talking.
Yes.
Not physical, but it is a metaphysical one. Well, this is good. Let's, Patrick, did you want to say anything else about this before we sign off today?
Oh, I just thought of a silly thing, but do you guys ever talk to the people that are gone? Whether it's...
Oh, I talk to my dad all the time.
Constantly,
yeah, 83. So it's not silly at all. It's very important.
Oh. No, I literally I speak to them out loud very often, and that's I've always said anybody's been around me, I have the speakers on outside of my head, and some people are more internal, but I if you want to know what I'm thinking, all you got to do is stand near me, and you'll hear it. And it's like, but no, that's. That stuff is like what Carol was talking about. Relationships die. I mean, people die, but relationships never do. And I had somebody when I said that to in one workshop one time, they said, well, they said it with kind of some resentment. They said, well, it sure as hell changes the relationship quite a bit. And I go like, I'll give you that. It does. It does, but the person is, you still have that relationship. And yeah, and I the older I get, the more people I lose, Patrick, the more I'm chatting them up. I've got a little entourage of dead people hanging out.
I bet your crowd gets pretty raucous.
We do. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you guys.
Good to see you all. Bye.
Bye, Carol.
Bye.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.